WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the military correspondent for the New York Times, Michael Gordon. We invited him to talk about the military campaign in Afghanistan and the difficulties in reporting on this new war. Michael Gordon is the Times' former Moscow bureau chief. He's covered the Gulf War and the conflicts in Chechnya and Kosovo. We spoke earlier today. Before the bombing campaign started, we were told that there were very few real targets in Afghanistan, yet we've been bombing for over a week and a half. What's your understanding of the bombing strategy?
I think that the United States, and this is almost entirely an American operation at this point in time, is engaged in a classic air campaign. It's the same sort of air campaign that I covered during the Iraq War and during the war in Kosovo. And in this campaign, the first thing you do is knock out the enemy's air defenses to achieve a measure of air superiority. Then you go after his so-called command and control targets. And in this case, it also includes efforts to try to bomb the Taliban leadership itself and go after his forces in the field. But I think this classic air campaign is married to a very unorthodox use of ground forces, which heavily emphasize special operations forces. The second phase hasn't yet unfolded, but I think it will begin shortly.
How shortly are you thinking?
I really have no idea, but there's an aircraft carrier off the not far from Pakistan, which has no airplanes on it. Instead, what it has is helicopters and Army Special Operations troops. And the concept is that they'll stage through Pakistan, meaning they'll move into bases in Pakistan, not be there for a long period of time en route to Afghanistan.
How much information do you expect to be getting from the Pentagon on what the special operations are doing?
Well, we're not getting very much in what the conventional forces are doing. This is a very difficult war to cover for a variety of reasons. First off, we don't have reporters in Taliban-held areas of Afghanistan, we being the New York Times, nor do virtually all Western news organizations, although there's some stringers there for the wire services. So we don't see firsthand what's happening in the country. Second off, some of these operations are being launched from so-called coalition partners, which are not enthusiastic about revealing their degree of cooperation with the United States. For example, AC-130 gunships, which are these Air Force Special Operations gunships, are based in Oman, and they fly to over Afghanistan and attack their targets near Kandahar. But this is nowhere officially acknowledged, and there are no reporters in Oman to document this. Thirdly, the Pentagon briefings have not been particularly good. They're sort of bare bones, are not as good as they were during the Gulf War, and that reflects the current, I think, sort of attitude on a number of factors, but it reflects an attitude about the Pentagon leadership that that is very uncomfortable with providing too much information. There's some legitimate security concerns there, but it's also an attitude, I think, about the media generally. There's another way into it a little bit. The British are an important ally. In fact, they're the only military ally at this point in time. They don't play much of a role in the air campaign, but they will play a substantial role in the ground operation. They've been much more candid about what they're planning on doing, and the factors that are influencing their planning, including weather.
What are they saying that the Pentagon isn't?
Well, they talk rather openly about our coming ground operation. They don't give the specific details, but they discuss the weather as a factor, whether it's better to launch this operation before the winter or after the winter. They were the first to reveal the total number of targets struck, which is now over 60. My source for that is the British military. I couldn't get that from the Pentagon. And they also were the first to give what they consider to be a realistic time frame for the operation, which is, I think it was last week, they said they were looking in spring, summer, and maybe even beyond.
In today's Times, you report that there are no indications that there are large numbers of U.S. ground troops that will be deployed. What clues are you looking for to evaluate what the likelihood of a lot of U.S. ground troops deployed will be?
Well, I don't know how many ground forces are going to be deployed, quite honestly. But Pentagon officials have indicated that they do not intend to deploy a massive number of ground forces, and there is zero desire to repeat the mistakes of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the subsequent occupation, where you have thousands and thousands of troops tied down and trying to occupy a country which doesn't welcome a foreign presence. So there's no interest in doing that. Basically, the Pentagon wants to get control of the air, knock out the Taliban army as much as possible from the air, conduct their raids to essentially fragment the Taliban, overthrow Mullah Omar and hunt for bin Laden and get out. They're not looking to get tied down in an occupation of Afghanistan. It's not militarily desirable, and it's not politically desirable, because the politics of that vis-a-vis the Islamic world are not good. So, and President Bush has spoken to this and said that the administration has learned a lesson from observing what the Soviets did in Afghanistan. He hasn't spelled it out, but this is the lesson that they've learned.
How much do you think we're relying or are going to rely on Northern Alliance troops?
I think the Bush administration is very conflicted on this point. The Northern Alliance is an anti-Taliban group that's dominated by Uzbeks and Tajiks by ethnicity. The dominant ethnic group in the country are Pashtuns. That's the group that gave rise to the Taliban. It's also the group that from which the exiled king comes. The exiled king is a figure that may play a role in a post-Taliban regime to unite different groups. So the dilemma is that the Northern Alliance is really the only fighting force on the ground that could be allied with the United States. It's not even, it's a group, but it has several different factions. And so they're the only fighting force that's willing to fight alongside us, so to speak, in Afghanistan at this point in time, because so far the CIA hasn't been able to mobilize any resistance in the South. That's on the plus side. On the negative side, they're not representative of the entire population, and there's a rather bitter relationship between the Northern Alliance and Pakistan, which is a key coalition partner and a staging ground for some of the military operations. So what you have is Secretary Rumsfeld emphasizing the, especially a few weeks ago, the military potential of the Northern Alliance, and Secretary Colin Powell emphasizing the need to keep things on an even keel with Pakistan. And this tension has resulted in a very kind of unclear relationship with the Northern Alliance. I talk to them every day, sometimes here in Washington, sometimes through our correspondents in their territory in Afghanistan. And what the United States appears to be doing is carrying out bombing raids that indirectly aid the Northern Alliance. For example, they've hit some targets around this town, Mazar-i Sharif, which is a key objective. They hit the airfield. They've hit some of the Arab troops that bin Laden's recruited. They've hit some tanks. This indirectly benefits the Northern Alliance as it weakens the Taliban in that area. What they're not doing so far is hitting the frontline troops that directly oppose the Northern Alliance or closely coordinating with the Northern Alliance.
Why aren't they hitting those frontline Taliban troops?
Why aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, because I think for a number of reasons, I'm not excluding that it could happen, but I think one reason is some of those frontline troops protect the approaches to Kabul or the path to Kabul. And the United States does not want the Northern Alliance to enter Kabul at this point in time for all the political reasons. The fear is that the Pashtuns and the rest of the country, far from welcoming the Northern Alliance, would rally around the Taliban because of the ethnic factor. The fear also is that Pakistan would object, which it has publicly already. And I think the U.S. wants to help the Northern Alliance without being perceived as being too closely connected to them. So it's trying to do it in an indirect way. That's the dilemma. This is not like Kosovo, where the U.S. covered that war. I was even in an airborne command post when the U.S. was doing bombing raids toward the end of that conflict. And the KLA, Kosovo Liberation Army, the Albanian group, would carry on attacks against the Serbs. The Serbs would come out to fight them, and the U.S. would call in airstrikes on the Serbs. We basically functioned as a sort of close air support for the KLA at the very end. There's nothing in this conflict that remotely resembles that in the amount of coordination, largely for political reasons.
Well, you reported recently that our military strategy in Afghanistan has outpaced our political strategy. And so if the Taliban give up, we don't have a plan in place yet. I guess this relates to what you were just talking about not bombing the Taliban ground troops. But can you talk a little bit more about how our military strategy seems to have outpaced our political strategy?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot easier to destroy something than to create something. And what's happening now is the air campaign is, they keep finding things to attack and weakening the Taliban and going after their army, even though they're not doing everything the Northern Alliance would like. But there's no agreement yet on the nature of the regime that would replace the Taliban. There's the Northern Alliance is one element of it. The Pashtuns associated with the king are another potential element of it. So-called moderate Taliban, if indeed they exist, may be a third element of it. And these groups, number one, are not working together in any real way at this point in time. It's not clear what this new regime would look like. It's all rather complicated by the fact that Pakistan wants to maintain its influence in Afghanistan, and the Northern Alliance is very much opposed to that. And the American effort, even though President Bush keeps saying we're trying to help these friendly forces on the ground, the covert effort to help these groups seems to be proceeding very slowly for reasons that are hard for me to determine from here. But so far, you know, arms and have not been pouring into these groups. It's been hard to recruit these groups. So the point of that article, which I think is largely accurate, is that we may find ourselves in a position where the Taliban are toppled, but there's a power vacuum in Afghanistan, which is undesirable because we don't want the entire country to dissolve into chaos, into even a more chaotic situation than it's in now.
So do you think that we might actually slow up the military campaign so that it doesn't outpace our political abilities, our political strategy?
Well, I think one thing they've done is they've tried to recalibrate the military campaign by not bombing the frontline troops to allow the Northern Alliance to get into Kabul. There's no agreement on what government should occupy Kabul, therefore you don't open the door for these guys to get into Kabul. I think it's affected it in that way. And I should say that Secretary Powell in Pakistan has been talking about these issues, about forming a government. But the danger in slowing up the military campaign is you lose momentum. And if you're going to insert your own ground forces, you really have to maintain a full court press and keep the heat on. If you let up, you're losing the momentum. You're giving the enemy a little bit of a breather. And you're making things harder for American and British forces when they do carry out their special operations. It's a very complicated war, which involves juggling not only military factors and considerations about weather and terrain, but a lot of political factors. There are different coalitions. There's the coalition within Afghanistan, the so-called internal coalition, the Northern Alliance and whatever Pashtuns we can get to join our side. Then there's a political coalition among the surrounding states, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Oman. And then there's a military coalition, which so far is just the United States and Britain. So there are really three separate coalitions involved in this campaign, and the administration has to juggle all of them.
My guest is Michael Gordon, military correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Gordon is my guest, military correspondent for the New York Times. How much of this terrorist threat that we're facing now do you think is blowback from the Gulf War?
It's hard to say. I mean, I have no idea what motivates someone like bin Laden. I mean, people say that he was aggrieved when he saw that there were American troops in Saudi Arabia, and which his own country had invited in to defend his own country against Saddam Hussein. I think it's more general than that. I think there's enormous resentment in the Arab world about American support for Israel. And I think also there's just a lot of resentment. It's not only the only superpower in the world, its culture is, popular culture anyway, is spreading around the world and jeopardizing the traditions of some of these societies. So I think it's much deeper than that. And I don't think it's going to go away. And I don't think that an American victory in Afghanistan is going to put an end to it. It's very difficult to get terrorists. You don't know where they hide. And they may be a little bit irrational. They're willing to fight to the finish. They're willing to give their own lives. How do you stop these kinds of people? But the governments that give them shelter and give them support, they can't hide. They have capitals and armies and radio towers and compounds. They can't hide. And they're more pragmatic. They generally don't want to give up their lives. They want to stay in power and perpetuate their power. So a good point of leverage on the terrorists is to go after the regime that gives them aid and comfort, which indeed is a strategy here. And I think it's a sensible strategy. And I think it's really about the only thing you can do. And I think there, it will be instructive if the United States topples the Taliban regime. It'll be a message to other nations that if you give some comfort and shelter and support to terrorists who attack the United States, there's a huge price to pay. Maybe it'll be political coercion. Maybe it'll be a covert CIA operation against you. Maybe it'll be a military strike. But you probably don't want to do this if you want to stay in power. I think that's a useful message to send. At the same time, I don't expect this to end the terrorist threat to the United States. And I think it will also, there'll be a whole, a lot of people in the Islamic world will be very angry about what the United States is, has done in Afghanistan and will plot new attacks.
How has the Pentagon been handling its mistakes, like the accidental bombing of a residential neighborhood in Afghanistan and the accidental bombing of a Red Cross supply warehouse?
Well, not too badly, in the sense that these sort of mistakes are really inevitable part of warfare. They happen in every conflict. They can't really be avoided. If you think they can be avoided, you're kidding yourself. It's just part of what comes with when you unleash the dogs of war, so to speak. And I think they're making every effort to avoid them because there's certainly no desire to hurt civilians, and also the politics of it are very bad. This all gets on Al Jazeera and leads to demonstrations in Pakistan and where we want to put some troops and creates all sorts of problems in the Islamic world. So they're certainly trying to avoid them. In fact, on Friday, they did, I wouldn't call it a pause, but on Friday, which is the Muslim Sabbath, they really did hold down some of the bombing raids out of respect for that. That's something they didn't do, by the way, during the Gulf War. And then no sooner did they resume than they accidentally sent a missile into a residence and killed a few people. So I can assure you there was no interest in doing that. It undercut the whole point of observing the Muslim Sabbath. But I think they've been reasonably upfront about disclosing them and acknowledging them and accepting responsibility for them and just saying it's the price of doing business when you have a war.
What about the food that we've been dropping? We've been dropping food to help people in Afghanistan and also as a public relations campaign to show that we're not against the people, we're just against terrorism. Do you think it's been effective? Do you have a reading on that?
I don't think the Pentagon itself believes that it's that effective. Certainly it has some benefit, but the real way to get food into the country is by land convoys. The Pentagon will be the first to acknowledge that. So they describe what they're doing as a sort of a supplement and not the principal way of helping people. I think there is an obvious political dimension to it, which is the administration wanted to be able to say from the very beginning that it wasn't merely bombing targets in Afghanistan, but helping people there. In fact, sometimes they've carried the spin a little bit too far. And I've heard military pilots interviewed on television that say the reason we're bombing the air defenses is so that we can deliver food. But it's of some modest benefit, but the principal way to get the food in is on the ground, which is an effort that's now underway through Iran, from Pakistan, from the north, involving mules and all sorts of stuff. I'm not the world's greatest expert on that, but that's the way to really help the people.
Michael Gordon is the military correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Michael Gordon, military correspondent for the New York Times. He's covering the new war against terrorism. He's the Times' former Moscow bureau chief. He covered the conflicts in Chechnya and Kosovo, as well as the Gulf War. We spoke earlier today. I'm wondering how the Cheney and Powell that you're seeing now compare to the Cheney and Powell that you covered during the Gulf War.
I think they're the same people. I think that the war minister for the U.S. government is Cheney. They keep him out of wraps because they don't want him to overshadow the president. I think they even had him in a bunker somewhere in West Virginia because they said the president and the vice president couldn't be together for security reasons. But as best I can figure, Cheney really is the key figure behind the scenes, or certainly he's more key than anybody else. And I think that he's a pragmatic person with hardline instincts. It was Cheney who advised Don Rumsfeld to go to the Middle East prior to the airstrikes. Rumsfeld, strangely enough, had not even been to visit the Persian Gulf states, and here we were about to start a war in South Asia, which depended to a certain extent on their cooperation, and there was no high-level Pentagon contact with them, at least not person to person. Cheney understood that because he had done that himself in the Gulf War. I think Powell's instincts are pretty much the same as they were during the Gulf War. Powell is also pragmatic, but he tends to be cautious. And I think Powell's instincts, for example, are to keep the relationship with Pakistan steady, more they are than to aid the Northern Alliance. I think Powell, unlike Rumsfeld, was initially more uncomfortable to talk about toppling the Taliban regime. Indeed, he still talks about working with moderate members of the Taliban regime. And I think Powell is very much against this notion of extending this war against Afghanistan to involve military conflicts against terrorist groups in other nations.
What are some of the problems Powell sees with extending the campaign to other countries?
Well, there's an obvious short-term problem, which is that the coalition the U.S. has assembled is a delicate one. I mean, remember, this is an administration that was essentially unilateralist when it took power, didn't put a lot of stock on multinational diplomacy, multilateral diplomacy, and yet found itself in the position of having to construct marriages of convenience, essentially. And if the United States were to expand its war aims beyond Afghanistan, let's say to include Iraq, which, by the way, so far has not been linked to any of the terrorism, although I don't know how this anthrax investigation may affect that determination. But if the U.S. expanded it, it would be very difficult to hold together the coalition that it does have. The British, for example, are lone military allies so far in this, have made it clear they're in this for the Afghanistan conflict. They're not in it for Iraq. So that's a practical reason for doing it. So I think from Powell's perspective, what he would like is to achieve the U.S. aims in this war and then go back to more of the traditional instruments for fighting terrorism, economic sanctions, political pressure, high-level diplomacy, but not bombing strikes. I think the Pentagon, at least civilian leadership, not the military, looks at it a little bit differently. And they see counterterrorism as sort of the rationale now for the Pentagon in the 21st century. Basically, the war against terrorism is an organizing principle now for defense, much as containing Soviet power was during the Cold War. And so just because you finish up with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan doesn't mean you wouldn't want to begin thinking about how to go after Al-Qaeda networks in other countries or other terrorist groups. They look at it from their vantage point, fighting terrorism. Why why not take on some of these other groups that have been linked to the deaths of Americans and are plotting things against us, even if it causes some political problems? And you get a taste of this in what Rumsfeld says when he says that the coalition shouldn't determine the mission should determine the coalition. That seems to imply, look, if we want to go after a group, we pull together a coalition to go after that group. If we look at another group, we pull together a coalition. Maybe we don't even have a coalition if no one will go with us, but maybe that shouldn't deter us. So these are very, very different perspectives. The Bush administration has not resolved this debate. This debate goes on today within the administration. Essentially, what they did is they punted. They said, Afghanistan will be phase one, and then we'll deal with phase two later. They just didn't say how.
Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld were both Cold Warriors. Now they're forming alliances with Russia and with former Soviet republics like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. You must often wonder what's going through their minds as they participate in these new alliances with places that used to be their enemies.
I don't think these alliances go very deep at this point in time. I think they're marriages of convenience. I think that the Bush administration's position on Russia has been very interesting. It's been a bit of a flip-flop. During the campaign, candidate Bush was pretty critical of the Russians. And just before he took office and immediately afterward, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, others, Condi Rice, accused the Russians of selling dangerous technologies all around the world and basically said the one reason we have to build a missile defense, even though you don't like it, is because you guys have been selling too much missile technology to countries like Iran. Bush refused to talk to Putin for some period of time. The Russians kept trying to arrange a telephone call, a meeting, anything. And the White House essentially dissed them and said that you're in the bottom of our list of things to do today. Thank you very much. We're going to Mexico first and Canada. Do we even talk about Mexico and Canada in a serious way now? Those are our main allies because they're geographically close, and I've been there before. And then we're going to meet with the Japanese, and they were sort of had a concept of concentric circles. First you do North America, then you do your allies, then you get around to China and Russia. That began to change because of the missile defense debate. The Europeans became very anxious that missile defense would upset the Russians and lead to a new confrontation. So what the administration did at that point was they made a display of engaging with the Russians. I call it conspicuous engagement, to try to persuade the Europeans that you can have your cake and eat it too. We can do missile defense and not upset things with the Russians. And they not only started returning Putin's phone calls, but they acted as if they were the best of friends. The current conflict has extended that trend because we do need some Russian cooperation. Not a lot, but a little bit, primarily because the U.S. military wants to operate out of Central Asia. And even though Uzbekistan and Tajikistan are former Soviet states and independent, it is an area of Russian influence. Now, what's the payoff for the Russians? Well, part of it is the administration changed their tune on Chechnya, of all things, having condemned that as a grievous human rights situation. Now they sound much more sympathetic about it. They still criticize the indiscriminate use of force, but they suggest that Russia is at least in part battling terrorists, so they gave the Russians a little more support there. I don't expect it to affect the administration's push for missile defense. And I think it remains to be seen whether this measure of cooperation with Moscow leads to anything that approaches a strategic partnership, because that certainly doesn't exist at this point in time. The relationship with Russia is such that we're definitely not enemies, but we're not full-fledged partners either. We're sort of something in between.
My guest is Michael Gordon, military correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Gordon, military correspondent for the New York Times. In the alliances that we're forming now, are we giving arms to countries, high-grade arms and weapons that may someday be used against us?
I don't think so. I mean, The United States and Britain are doing the bombing. The Northern Alliance has weapons. I don't think there's a shortage of weapons in the region. I'm not quite sure what we're doing with the Northern Alliance, but I would guess that we're supplying them with money and they're going to go buy arms from the Russians instead of us shipping them there, which is what they've been buying arms from the Russians for years, mostly using Iranian money. But we are suffering a little bit from some of the previous American covert operations in the region. For example, the Taliban are armed with Stingers, which is an anti-aircraft missile, which is not a threat to our current aircraft, really, but it's a potential threat to helicopter operations and slow-flying aircraft once the second phase of this conflict begins. Well, how did the Stingers get there? We gave them to them, not to the Taliban, but to the Mujahideen, so that they could use them against the Soviets during the war with Afghanistan. And then the CIA went around trying to buy them all back, and, well, lo and behold, some of these people decided they'd hang on to them. Thank you very much. So, you know, that's a little bit of an annoyance, but I don't see a similar trend in this conflict.
I want to get back to Cheney and Powell. Are there certain mistakes you think Cheney and Powell saw in the Gulf War that they're really trying to not make this time around?
Cheney and Powell didn't agree about the Gulf War. Cheney wanted to go to war against Iraq, and Powell didn't. So it wasn't they were always of one mind in that conflict. I think that was a very different type of conflict. First of all, you were fighting a very traditional army that had lots of tanks, and it had invaded a country, Kuwait, and then the country next to it, Saudi Arabia, was anxious, and so they were happy to take in American forces and let us use their nation essentially as a big aircraft carrier to launch our strikes. It's a very different type of conflict from this, in which you're fighting this Taliban ragtag army, whatever it is, of 20 to 40,000 guys and a bunch of 2 to 3,000 terrorists who are hard to root out. But I think if there was one lesson of the Gulf War, I don't think Cheney and Powell would necessarily agree with this, by the way, but I think if there was a lesson, it's that it's better not to leave certain things undone. And in the Gulf conflict, the war aims were limited to weakening Saddam Hussein and recovering Kuwait and reducing his military potential so that he couldn't reinvade Kuwait. But they didn't really extend to overthrowing his regime. That was in the category of nice to have, but not essential. I don't want to re-argue that issue. But I think in this case, they don't want to repeat that scenario. They want to definitely root out the al-Qaeda network from Afghanistan at a minimum and decapitate the Taliban regime, which is why the conflict is a little bit open-ended. They don't want to just punish them or fire off a bunch of cruise missiles and hurt them and leave them standing there. So this is much more a fight to the finish than the Gulf conflict was.
Michael Gordon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Gordon is the military correspondent for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today.